A chain hung across the entrance. A white sheet had been draped over the chain, words slapped on in black paint. All healthy here. Sick. Go on. But a folding table had been set up on their side of the rusty swinging chain. Set upon it were paper bowls of chicken noodle soup. Paper cups of water had been arranged in a row. The smell of the soup was enough to get Harper's saliva glands working and her stomach tightening with hunger. But that wasn't what really excited her. Set out on one corner of the table was a bottle of some kind of pink syrup and a little plastic syringe. It was the sort of syringe you might use to orally administer medicine to a dog or a small child. The label on the bottle said erythromycin and gave a dosage for someone named Lucky. It had expired over a year ago and was only half full, the outside of the bottle tacky with dried syrup. Pinned beneath the bottle was a ruled sheet of notebook paper. Heard you are with invalid. Will this help? Harper took the bottle in one hand and peered up at the Bucksport trading post. A black man in a flannel shirt, with gold spectacles resting on the end of his nose, peered back from behind a window crowded with knick-knacks. A carved wooden moose, a lamp with a driftwood base. Harper lifted a hand in a gesture of thanks. He nodded, his glasses flashing, and retreated into dimness. She gave John his first dose, squirting it into the back of his mouth, and followed with aspirin, while the others sat on the side of the road, tipping their paper bowls to their mouths to drink lukewarm soup. An orange detour for sick sign pointed them west, along a winding country road, away from the town of Bucksport itself. But they paused at a wooden sawhorse, sick do not cross, to peer along a lane that led into town and down toward the sea. The street was shaded with big leafy oaks and lined with 2- and 3-story colonials. It was late in the day, and Harper could see lights on in the houses, electric lights, and a street lamp casting a steely blue glow. My God, Renee said. We're back in a part of the world that has power. No, we aren't, Allie told her. That part of the world is on the other side of this sawhorse. What do you think would happen if we tried to cross? I don't know, and we're not going to find out. We're going to follow the signs and do what we're told, Harper said. Walk right this way, Allie said. Up the ramp and into the slaughterhouse. Single file, please. No shoving. If they wanted to kill us, they've had plenty of opportunities, Renee noted. Never mind me, Allie said. I'm just your typical jaded teenage leper. 27. They spent the night in a public campground that had been marked specifically for the use of the infected. The dirt road in was flanked by a pair of enormous wooden heads, carved to look like noble Indian chieftains, complete with sad, wise eyes and feather headdresses. Hung above the entrance was a banner that proclaimed, "Sick stay here, water, food, toilets." They slept under picnic tables, rain plopping on the wooden planks and dripping down on top of them. But there were porta-potties, an inconceivable luxury after over a week of using rags to wipe. And John surprised Harper by sleeping through the night, his chest rising and falling deeply, and his lean, lined face set in an expression of dreaming calm. He woke just once, when she put the syringe in his mouth to give him another squirt of the antibiotic. And even then he only made a small sound, an amused sort of snort, and slipped away again. They stayed in the campground most of the morning, waiting for the rain to pass. It quit around lunch, and the afternoon was fine for walking. A cool breeze shushed in the big-leafed oaks. The daylight glittered on every wet surface, made spiderwebs into nets studded with diamonds. They followed "This Way Sick" signs north and east, mostly north, past forest and lake. Once they passed a folding table by the side of the road where someone had set out a bowl filled with individually wrapped Oreo cookies, a steel jug with blessedly cold milk in it, and Dixie cups. There were no houses in sight. The table stood alone at the end of a dirt lane that led back into trees. "This is fresh," Harper said. She shut her eyes to savor an icy swallow. "It can't have been sitting outside for long." "No, course not. They know we're coming," the fireman croaked from his stretcher. Harper almost coughed milk up her nose. In the next moment they were all on their knees around the travois. John looked at them from half-shut eyes, his chin bristly and his cheeks caved in from all the weight he had lost. His color was ghastly. His smile was fond, but weak. "I wouldn't say no to some of that milk myself, Nurse Willows," he said, "if it won't interfere with my recovery." "Not at all, but I want you to take some aspirin with it." She put a hand behind his head, propping it up, and gave him slow sips from her own cup. She didn't say a thing. For the next 10 minutes, Allie and Renee were talking over each other while Nick gestured furiously with his hands, all of them trying to tell the story of the last week and a half at the same time. The fireman looked this way and that, and nodded sometimes, making a drowsy effort to attend to each of them. Harper wasn't sure how much he was getting, although his brow furrowed when Allie told him they had left Bucksport behind that morning. "The four of you carried me all the way to Bucksport." "No," Harper said, "just Allie." "Lucky your bony English ass is light," Allie said. "Lucky you don't know how to quit," John said to her. "Lucky for me. Thank you, Allie. I love you, girl." Allie wasn't good at the emotional stuff. She looked away into the trees, clenching her jaw and clamping down on some intense upswell of feeling. "Try not to get nearly killed again," she said, when she was able to speak. They all seemed to run out of things to say at the same time, and then there was a pleasant silence, no sound except for the swish of the cool wind in the trees and the twittering of the birds. Harper found herself holding John's hand. "Perhaps we can procure me a crutch," he said, "or fashion one. I wouldn't like to burden you all any longer." "Let's not get ahead of ourselves," Harper said. "Yesterday this time, I wasn't sure you'd live to see another morning. That bad." "Buddy," Harper said, "I thought you were smoked." "Ha ha," he said. "Good one, Willows." 28. He slept through most of the next 24 hours, waking only to eat meals. Dinner was cold beef stew, left out on the side of the road in a deep steel pot. There were no bowls, so they took turns drinking right from the ladle. It was rich, so rich it made Harper a little light-headed, and salty and gluey in consistency. Big carrots and buttery pieces of beef and a smoky undertaste of bourbon. Harper didn't care that it was cold. She could not remember a better meal in all her life. John couldn't manage the big pieces, but he was able to get down some peas and a few of the smaller bits of beef, and when he dozed off again, Harper thought his color was better. Early on the afternoon of the following day, they found themselves at the bottom of a long rise, the sides of the road crowded with leafy oaks, so that the two-lane blacktop passed beneath a canopy of pale green. Sunlight flashed and winked through the waving branches, and a dappled brightness danced across the road. It was a long, sweaty trudge to the top of the hill, but the climb was worth it. At the top, the trees parted to the right, to reveal a view that went for miles, across meadows and dense bands of forest. Harper saw grazing cows and the roofs of a few farmhouses, and beyond it all was a dark blue reach of ocean. When Harper breathed deeply, she thought she could almost smell it. John had missed their glimpse of the sea when they crossed through Bucksport and asked Allie to turn him so he could admire the scenery. She held him tilted almost upright in the drag sled while he stared out across the fields, drenched in golden mid-afternoon light and onto the deep blue water. The wind whisked back his hair from his smooth brow. Every time Harper looked at his forehead, she wanted to kiss it. "Is that a sailboat?" John said, narrowing his eyes. "Does anyone else see a sail?" All of them stood there squinting.
"I don't see anything," Renee said.
"Me neither," Harper said. Allie pointed. "Yeah, there," John said. "Do you see something on the sail? A little splash of red?" Allie peered into the distance. "No. Why?" But John had turned his head and asked Nick with a few gestures what he saw. Nick nodded and replied. Harper didn't catch it. "What did he say?" "Nick's eyes are best," John replied, in a slightly irritating tone of satisfaction. "He sees the little splash of red, too."
So what? Harper asked. You never saw the Bobby Shaw out on the water, he told her. The boat. But I did. I was out in it a time or two, the year I was a counselor at Camp Wyndham. There's a picture of a large red crab on the sail.
No,
Renee said. I know what you're saying, John, but it can't be Don Lewiston. It can't. It's been 4 weeks. I don't know how long it would take to get from Portsmouth, New Hampshire to Machias by sail, but not almost a month.
We ran into a few setbacks along the way, he said mildly. Maybe Don did, too. They stood there a while longer, and then, without a word, Allie turned the travois and began to tramp on. One by one the others fell in behind her, until only Harper remained, squinting hard into the distance. There, on the very line of the horizon, a tiny white splinter against all that blue, with a little red fleck upon it. 29. They were perhaps 50 miles from Machias the morning they found the crutch. It was by then 2 days since John had woken and asked for a glass of milk. Allie had gone on hauling the drag sled. There was no other reasonable option. And John had rediscovered his voice, which he used to complain about being shaken and bumped. He kvetched about itches he couldn't reach, a sore back, and the sun in his eyes. I liked it better when you were dying, Allie said. You didn't bitch so much. Look sharp, Allie. I think you missed a pothole back there. You don't want to break up your streak of dragging me over every one. Allie slowed, straightened up, and stretched her back. You want a break from me? Be careful what you wish for, smartass. You just might get one.
Is that what I think it is?
It leaned against the trunk of a great old oak, with a red bandana tied around it so it would catch their eye. A stainless steel crutch with a yellow foam armpit pad. No note, no explanation. A white cottage stood behind a picket fence nearby, but the windows were dark. If they were being watched, Harper felt sure they were. She couldn't tell from where. Nick undid the bungee cords that held John to the travois and helped him up. Allie supported him while he fitted the crutch under one arm. He was testing it out, hobbling in little circles, when Harper noticed Renee blinking at tears.
So much kindness, Renee said. So many people looking after us. They don't know a thing about us except we're in need.
I read a Cormac McCarthy novel once, about the end of the world. People hunting dogs and each other and frying up babies, and it was awful.
But we need kindness like we need to eat.
It satisfies something in us we can't do without. Or maybe they just want us to hurry up, Allie said. The sooner we go on our way, the safer they are.
It's hard to imagine a sinister agenda behind the food they've left out for us, the soup, the pitchers of milk. I just can't imagine a secret wicked purpose behind supplying us with endless goodies.
Neither could Hansel and Gretel, the fireman said.
Shall we limp on?
I think I'll stretch my one good leg for a while.
30. He lasted all of 5 minutes before he sat on the curb, white and sweaty and shaking, and agreed to climb on the stretcher again. All the talk seemed to go out of him, and he bore every thump and bump with gritted teeth. The next day, though, he crutched along with them for half an hour in the morning, and another 20 minutes in the afternoon. He was better still the day after that, and kept up with them for most of the AM. On the fourth day after they found the crutch, he hobbled along on his own power from breakfast until they broke for lunch, only resting when Harper insisted. Lunch was a selection of mushy brown cupcakes and some bologna sandwiches wrapped in wax paper. Someone had dropped them in a plastic shopping bag and left them dangling from a mailbox at the end of a gravel driveway. Harper unwrapped one of the sandwiches and took a whiff. It had a faintly corrupt odor, like the inside of a sneaker. They stuck with the cupcakes, at first. But Harper carried the bag, and at some point, late in the day, found herself tucking into one of the sandwiches in spite of herself.
I hope that doesn't make you sick, Renee said. You are 9 months pregnant.
9 months and a week, and that's why I'm eating it, Harper said. I can't help myself.
After the third bite, though, she was finally able to taste it and knew it was spoiled. At first she had missed the slimy texture of the meat and a faint but definite sour flavor that brought to mind sepsis. She spat it out and tossed what was left of the sandwich in the grass with a revulsion that approached moral horror. She was guiltily licking bright yellow mustard off her fingertips when the fireman said, "Hold up!" Harper lifted her head to see what had caught his attention, and saw a pair of jeeps, parked in such a way as to block both lanes of the highway, nose to nose. A pair of men stood in yellow rubber overalls and yellow masks with clear faceplates, yellow booties and yellow gloves. Harper recognized it as the same outfit she had worn during her weeks as a nurse in Portsmouth Hospital. The sentinels carried assault rifles. One of them stepped forward, hand raised, palm outward. Harper wasn't sure if this gesture meant for them to halt, or if he was simply waving hello. Allie stopped walking, took Nick's hand, and squeezed it to indicate he should stop as well. Renee walked past them without missing a step. "You really think we ought to just hand ourselves over?" Allie asked. Renee tossed a casual glance back. "Oh, Allie, we've been in their hands for days." A third man sat in one of the jeeps. He wore yellow, too, although he had his hood off, so Harper could see a full head of white hair and a big, craggy face. He had a knee on the steering wheel and a slender paperback open across his thigh. It looked like he was working a crossword. "Five on the road, Jim," said one of the armed men, his voice muffled by his mask. Jim looked up from his book and gazed mildly around. He had a big, humorous beak of a nose and pale eyes and overgrown eyebrows. He dropped his crossword puzzle and hopped out. He squeezed between the gunmen, and as he did, he reached out absent-mindedly and put his hand on the barrel of one of the machine guns, nudging it so it pointed down at the blacktop. Harper took this as a promising gesture. "Welcome to Machias," called the one named Jim, slowing as he walked toward them. "You've had quite a walk. Dorothy didn't have to go half as far with Toto."
"Are you going to take us to Oz?" Renee Gilmanton asked.
"It's not exactly the Emerald City," Jim said, "but they've got hot water and power out on the island."
His gaze drifted to Harper's stomach, and for a moment his smile faltered, and he looked thoughtful and a little sad.
"Doctors, too, although their head researcher, Professor Houston, died in the big fire back in January."
"Big fire?" Renee asked. "Does that mean what I think it means?"
"No cure, I'm afraid," Jim said, "and more than a few setbacks, including one mishap that was, well, pretty awful. No way around it. A whole control group of 30 infected had some kind of reaction to a drug they were testing. They all went up within a few hours of each other. The fire slipped out of control and burnt down the central medical facility, although the remaining staff has set up shop in a farmhouse. Now don't you worry. We sent word one of you was pregnant and looked to be pretty far along. When are you expecting?"
"I believe I'm a few days overdue, actually," Harper said. Jim shook his head.
"At least you didn't have to deliver on the road. The medical folk out on the island are aware of your condition. They've got a bed all made up for you."
Harper was surprised by the intensity of her relief. For a moment her legs felt wobbly beneath her. Something, some muscular ache, a cramped tightness, seemed to let go behind her chest. Some part of her that had been clenched up, perhaps for months.
"If we move, we can have you there by midnight," Jim said. "It's a 3-hour ride in the boat, and we have to pass you through processing before we can depart. The good news is we knew you were coming. Boat is already loaded, prepped to go."
"What's he saying?" Nick asked with his hands.
Harper explained. The man named Jim watched, his bushy eyebrows knitted together, half-smile on his face.
"Deaf?" he asked, and when she nodded he shook his head. "Deaf and infected. Some kids get all the luck."
He crouched down, hands on his knees, to look into Nick's face, and in a very loud voice, moving his lips slowly, he said,
"There's plenty of kids where you're going. Lots of little guys to play with."
Nick looked at Harper, and she explained with her hands, standing to one side. Nick's reply required no translation at all. He gave a thumbs up.
Jim nodded, satisfied, and slopped his mask onto his head.
Come on, jump in the jeep.
Harper walked beside the fireman. She held his elbow with one hand and carried the portable mother in the other. She raised her voice to be heard over a sudden gusting wind.
I have only two questions. When do we get to meet Martha Quinn, and does she take requests?
Jim glanced back at them as he got behind the wheel. Through the plastic window in his mask, he smiled.
You'll be with her before you know it.
He didn't answer the second question. 31. After 20 days of walking, Harper found the rush of moving at high speed in a jeep a little alarming. She sat up front, next to Jim. Renee and the fireman sat in back. Allie squeezed between them, and Nick perched on Renee's lap. One of the gunmen traveled with them, too, although he sat on the very back of the jeep, holding onto the roll bar, his feet dangling over the rear fender, and his gun swinging carelessly from a strap around his neck. It didn't help Harper's troubled stomach any when Jim turned the jeep around and drove it up onto a wide gravel path, not a road at all. They jounced over ruts and potholes, the branches of fir trees whipping past above them. Jim said they were on something called the Sunrise Trail.
This thing was intended for bicycles, he said, by way of apology, and hikers. But it's the best way to take you out to the processing center without bringing you through town.
The fireman leaned forward.
I'm surprised you're wearing all that gear. They must thoroughly understand how transmission works by now after, what, a year of study? If we understand it, they must. You're experts out on the island.
Jim listened but didn't reply.
It's the ash, the fireman yelled to be heard over the roar of the slipstream. If you don't come in contact with the ash, there's nothing to worry about. That's one theory, Jim said with a tight half-smile. It's not one theory, it's the fact, the fireman said. You some kind of biologist? I used to teach at UNH. I'm sure they'll be glad to have your expertise, Jim called back. Put you right to work.
The way he said it, Harper wasn't sure if he was making fun or being serious. Back on the highway, it had been a dim, rose-tinted dusk. Beneath the trees, it was already full, splendid night, the pines whipping by in a warm blast of darkness. Through gaps in the trees, Harper glimpsed an estuary, a broad plate of black glass under a blushing sky. She spotted a scattering of electric lights, the town over there somewhere. The fireman leaned forward again.
You still have power. Do you have cell phone coverage as well? I'm curious how folks were able to pass word up the road that we were coming. We're very grateful to everyone who put food out for us, Renee called.
Harper was grateful to everyone who had put out food except for whoever decided to get rid of their rancid bologna by dumping it on the pregnant lady. Her stomach was a knot of worms.
Yeah, power in some places, though it's spotty and it goes out quite a bit. No cell phone coverage, but we've got a working landline system in Machias. The governor saw to that. And we can communicate with people farther away by CB.
Jim thought for a moment, the steering wheel rocking gently in his hand, then said,
We don't get too many coming from the south anymore. Not across the wastelands. We don't get many at all these days. But when we do have new arrivals, they're usually from the north, across from Canada. How many have you saved? Harper yelled.
She thought talking might help take her mind off her building nausea.
694 men, women, and children, Jim proclaimed. And with you, it'll be 699. No, make it 700 on the dot, counting baby. Can't forget baby.
We need to talk about that, Harper said.
About who will take him, assuming he's born without contamination. What do you mean? It's been a while since I've read the medical literature, but last I heard, there was a hypothesis that the children of mothers with dragon scale are unlikely to carry the infection themselves. I'm afraid my medical expertise pretty much ends at putting on band-aids when my 8-year-old scrapes her knee.
But there must have been children born on the island with almost 700 people there. Maybe?
Above my pay grade, he said cheerfully.
The trees began to break up, and to the right of the jeep, Harper saw high grass, a stretch of wet sand, and distant water. Out across a bay stood a lighthouse, sweeping the ocean. It did actually resemble a candle on the water, a thick white one, lit to mark a child's first birthday, perhaps.
"If the baby is born uncontaminated," Harper tried again, "I'd like to have some say over the foster family." "I don't know anything about that. I haven't heard of anyone adopting sick babies." "He won't be sick," she said, feeling he was missing the crucial point. Jim's smile broadened behind his clear plastic faceplate. "It's a boy. You know that for certain." "Yes," Harper said. It felt certain to her.
She waited for him to comment, but Jim felt quiet again. She decided to leave it. Suppose she could coordinate with the medical staff on the island. The trees fell away and they went on and on. To the right was a shabby, tilting fence of pickets and wire. Harper saw in the distance a striped yellow and white tent, brightly aglow, a sight that made her think of small-town fairs. There would be a bucket to bob for apples under there, and a place to buy caramel corn. As they approached the pavilion, the grass thinned out on their left, and Harper saw a narrow road running parallel to their trail. Up ahead was a parking lot. Off to one side of the big striped tent, a few cars parked there. Harper smelled the boat before she saw it, a sickening stench of cheap diesel. Her stomach flopped. As they rolled the last few hundred feet to the processing area, she saw a dock at the end of a spit and a dirty fishing trawler, the Maggie Atwood, written in cheery cursive across the back. Men in full-body biohazard outfits carried cardboard boxes down the ramp and onto the deck. Beneath the pavilion were a few long folding tables. Christmas lights had been strung along the steel pipes overhead, creating a weirdly festive air. It was almost crowded, 9 or 10 people in yellow rubber suits moving around behind the tables. A steel pot steamed on a camp gas burner in one corner.
"They've got cocoa," said Jim, "and gingerbread cookies, and a pretty good turkey stew. Everyone gets fed before they go across the water."
Harper turned in her seat and moved her hands, passing along the good news to Nick. He grinned and signed back to her.
"Look at all the lights. It's like where Santa lives. It's like we walked all the way to Christmas land."
Harper signed, "I think you mean the North Pole," but Nick wasn't paying attention anymore, craning his head to see into the pavilion. Jim turned the jeep into a place where the grass was flattened down and switched off the engine. They followed him into the tent, under the festive lights.
"Come meet the volunteers," he said.
The volunteers were all women, most middle-aged or older. They reminded Harper of the sort of cheerful, efficient old dolls who organized baked bean socials for their church. Jim led the refugees to the folding tables, where the first of the women waited for them with forms on a clipboard. Through the clear window in her rubber mask, she showed an eager grin and seemed especially delighted to see a little boy with them.
"Hello, and haven't you come a long way on foot? You must be exhausted. My name is Vivian. I'm going to take your information. Then we'll get a picture of each of you for the website and give you your housing assignments and some supplies for your trip."
"And some of that soup, I hope," Renee said. "Smells so good it's making me lightheaded."
Harper could smell it herself, an odor of chicken broth and stewed carrots mixed with the black stink of the boat. It made her feel very close to retching. It appalled her that she had been stupid enough to have even a single bite of that rotten sandwich. She should have had some sense, if not some self-restraint. She had let pregnancy turn her into a foul pig, and now she was getting what she deserved. She knew she was going to puke. She just didn't know when.
"You bet," Vivian cried. "Soup and fresh milk and coffee for the grown-ups, and we'll get you on your way. We'll make this as quick and painless as we can. Let's just begin with the basics. Who are you?"
Harper opened her mouth to speak, but Renee got there first.
"We're what's left of the Camp Wyndham conspiracy. These are our evil leaders, Mr. Rookwood and Nurse Harper. We come in peace."
Jim, who had moved behind the folding tables to join the grannies, threw back his head and barked a laugh at this.
"Woo-hoo," Vivian said, An evil conspiracy. Haven't had one of those yet. Well, we're a democratic conspiracy. Everyone gets a vote, even the kids. I don't know how I feel about that one. My kids would probably vote for ice cream for dinner and no bedtime. Did you get to vote on your bedtime? She asked Nick, bending down to look into his face. I'm afraid he's deaf, said the fireman. You're British. All the best evil masterminds are. And if my son did get a vote, he would probably vote for chicken stew before filling out forms. Harper almost missed him saying, my son. But she didn't miss it when John put his arm around her waist and added, my wife, too. Vivian put them down just as he said. Husband and wife, Mr. and Mrs. Rookwood. Harper didn't object. She felt that, in many ways, John had told the truth. She put her head on his shoulder while Vivian asked her questions and scratched down the answers. Vivian wanted to know how far they had come and where they had set out from. She asked when they got sick and where they had traveled since their infection. She wanted details on their symptoms, if they were prone to hot flashes, charring, smoking. Not at all, Renee said. We have a technique for pacifying the infection. Daily sing-alongs. Keeps it from going critical. You can bring the spore under control with almost any kind of group activity that brings pleasure. Something to do with a hormone your brain releases. Oxytocin? Nurse Harper can explain it best. But Nurse Harper didn't need to explain anything. Vivian smiled. I understand group therapies are very popular on the island and are still the most successful treatment. They have 80 sing-alongs after breakfast. Toto and Hall and Oates. In that case, the fireman said, I think I'd rather burn alive. There were a lot of questions about the impending baby. All of the women were excited, and the plump old woman who took their photos told Harper at length about her own first grandchild, little Kelly, who had been born 3 weeks before, and who she said sounded just like a sheep when she cried. Baa! Baa! Said the older woman, laughing. But when Harper said she was hoping to talk to someone about adoption for the baby, assuming it was healthy, the newly minted grandmother began to fiddle with her camera and looked vexed. This thing, she said, and wandered away. Farther down the table, the portable mother was opened and searched for weapons by a thin, indifferent woman with a sharp, narrow face and nothing to say. Yet another lady handed them blue folders, a thick stapled packet inside each. Harper saw a photocopied 30-page document, Free Wolf Island, A Guide to Health and Safety, published by the CDC. Each folder also had a real estate listing in it. Harper and John and the kids had been offered a two-bedroom, two-bathroom cottage at 3 Long Bay Road. A smeary black-and-white photo showed a small white cottage and a leaf-strewn backyard with a child's playset in it. Renee was offered a bedroom at 18 Long Bay, in the Long Bay Bed and Breakfast, which was a kind of dorm for half a dozen others. Some color photocopies showed the island from above, on a fall day, the trees dressed out in their autumn colors, a patchwork of rusty oranges and buttery yellows. A map of town marked out the clinic, the communal greenhouses, the town library, a former general store that was now serving as a supply distribution center, and other points of interest. At the end of the line of tables, a beaming Asian granny dished out paper bowls of stew and paper cups of milk, and they were directed to sit and rest their feet on a stack of hay bales just outside the pavilion. Harper couldn't eat. By the time they had made their way through processing, she was having contractions, bad ones, and her stomach was boiling with sickness. She sat on the edge of one of the bales and clutched her abdomen in both hands, grimacing. Her distress unsettled John, who skipped his meal as well and sat beside her, rubbing her back in circles. I haven't seen you like this, he said. Do you think you're going into labor? Her stomach cramped and she made a small sound of unhappiness, then shook her head. Get something to eat, John. You need your strength. Maybe in a minute, Harper, he said. But he never did get up, although Nick brought him a creamy, sugared coffee. They sat on the bales, on the outer edge of the light, John stroking Harper's back, and Harper waiting for her contractions to pass. They did, eventually,
but the nasty, slick feeling in her belly and intestines remained. Filthy clouds of black smoke rolled back up the beach from the boat, and when she caught a whiff of the stink, it took all her will not to gag. Before they departed, the woman named Vivian approached, holding a little shoebox. She brought it to Nick and held it out to him, then spoke to the fireman, so he could translate.
"These are all my Doctor Who episodes," she said. "There's a boy who went over to the island 3 months ago. He's a few years older than Nick here, about 14, and I happen to know he's a science fiction fan. I promised I'd get him my collection so he'd have something to watch. Will you tell Nick to give these to Jared Morris? And please tell Nick he can watch them, too. I think Jared would like that. I think Jared would also like a smart friend who can teach him sign language."
"You're too kind," John Rookwood said, and explained to Nick, who solemnly took the shoebox full of DVDs. When Vivian stood, her eyes glittered with tears.
"You people, I can't imagine what you've been through. I pray every night you'll be healed. A lot of us do. Someday you'll be back and you'll be well, and what stories you'll have."
"Thanks for everything you've done," Harper managed.
"I wish it was more," Vivian said. "Turkey stew and old DVDs for people who have been through hell. Turkey stew and old episodes of Doctor Who comes pretty close to my idea of heaven," Renee said.
Vivian nodded. She couldn't speak, was obviously overcome with emotion. She held her gloved fingertips to her faceplate and mimed kissing them, and then reached out and touched Nick's cheek.
"Tell Jared his aunt loves him."
She raised her hand in a last wave and turned away, blinking at damp eyes.
"Did you like the stew?" Renee asked Allie.
Allie gave her a blank look.
"It's okay. Can we get this show on the road?" "Yes," Jim said, walking over to them. "Let's. Your yacht awaits."
32. The boat beat its way down a wide inlet into the hard slap of the waves. Harper threw up over the side before the lights of the pavilion were out of sight. John stroked her neck while she gasped and spat.
"Want some of my coffee?" he said. "I've still got half. It'll get the taste out of your mouth."
She shook her head. He tossed the rest of his coffee over the side, and the paper cup, too.
"It wasn't very good anyway," he said.
The ship was grimy, the deck slopping with a quarter inch of nasty water. An exhaust pipe protruded from the rear of the little captain's cabin, and the wind blew the smoke back down on them, where they sat in the open on the stern. They huddled on cushioned seats along the side, squeezed into their orange life vests. Nick's vest was so big on him, most of him had disappeared behind it. There was nothing left to see of him except his head poking through the collar and his feet sticking out below.
"Is it raining?" Harper asked.
Cold, salty spray drizzled down on them.
"That's coming off the chop," John said.
"I think I hate the open ocean," Harper said.
They banged through a wave and Harper turned her head and vomited into their wake again.
There were three men in biohazard suits in the pilot's cabin. Jim, one of the gunmen from the checkpoint, and whoever was steering. The captain, Harper imagined. They hadn't been introduced.
"You told them we were married," Harper said, when she had recovered herself and wiped her lips.
"I was wondering about that. Remember you said that a fireman could grant divorces? What about marriages?"
"I'll tell you a secret. I'm not a real fireman, but the man steering the ship is a real captain, and they can marry people."
He looked at her with a sudden luminous gleam of inspiration.
"Miss Harper Willows, I think I should ask you something."
"No," she said. "No, don't. Please. I was just kidding, John." His head sank, and his expression took on a glum, downcast look. "But only because my answer might involve kissing. And I can't kiss you now. That would be gross, not with the taste of vomit in my mouth." Although now that she had been good and sick, her stomach felt better. Or would have, she thought, if the goddamn contractions hadn't started up once more. His face lit back up. She took his wet, cold hand and squeezed it. And his grin made his ears jut from the side of his head. Waves hit the boat and came over the rail in an icy, drenching spray.
Thank God for the rain slickers, Harper said as they crashed into another trough. This is miserable.
It isn't bothering Nick, nudging her with his elbow. I think he was out before they untied us from the dock.
He's done a lot of walking, Harper agreed. The boat pitched. She looked through the drizzle for the lighthouse she had seen earlier, but they were already too far out to see it.
John yawned into the back of his hand. Maybe I'll catch a few minutes of shut-eye myself.
How can you sleep in this?
I don't know, he said. Renee managed it, though.
Harper looked across the stern. Nick dreamed with his cheek against Renee's bosom. She slept with her chin on his head. Allie was awake, though, clutching her life preserver in both hands and staring darkly into the captain's cabin.
John, Harper said. John, why is Renee sleeping? Who could sleep in this?
Well, you said it yourself. We walked at least 15 miles today and...
Wake her up, Harper said.
I don't want to wake her up.
Try, please.
The fireman gave her a sidelong look, his gaze hooded and questioning, and then he rose on his crutch and leaned across the deck and shook Renee's knee.
Renee, Renee, wake up.
The boat slammed over another wave and unbalanced him. He managed to heave himself back onto his seat before he could fall down. Renee smiled in her sleep and showed no reaction.
What's wrong with them? Allie asked.
John's chin had sunk a little. Harper thought his eyes were just slightly unfocused.
God damn it, John said. Can't something work out? Just for once?
Allie shook Nick's shoulder. He slumped over, fell face first into Renee's lap.
The stew, John said.
The coffee, Harper said.
But Allie is fine.
I didn't have any, Allie said. I didn't trust them. I just pretended to have some, and I poured it out when no one was looking.
I wish you hadn't, Jim shouted to be heard over the engine and the wind.
He had opened the door to the pilot's cabin and leaned in it, staring out at them through his clear plastic faceplate. He had a .45 in one hand, but he wasn't pointing it at them, just casually holding it down by his leg.
We try and make it peaceful, Jim said. No fear, no pain. A little something to put you to sleep, and then over the side.
No, Harper said. No, 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 no. You can't. Please. This doesn't make any sense. Why? Why would you go through this big charade? Why didn't you just fucking shoot us? Anyone could have shot us any time. Why put on a big act for us?
But it isn't for us, the fireman said. Is it? Jim shrugged. I think it's nice for you folks to go out on a high note, to fall asleep dreaming of a place where you'll be safe, where you'll be looked after. Christ, we're human beings, not monsters. We don't want anyone to suffer. But no, no, we do it for the community. People like Vivian believe in the island, too, most of them. You don't know how important it is for morale to believe they're saving people, helping people. If they thought we were sailing out here just to throw people over the side, there'd be a lot of broken hearts. A lot of discontentment, too.
He paused while the boat crashed over another wave and steadied himself against the doorframe.
You have to understand. You folks said you're, what, the last remnant of a little democracy? You voted to come here? Well, we've got a democracy, too. Our own private leadership council. Just the governor and 12 others, including myself. You aren't the only ones who took a vote. So did we. And this is what we voted for.
There's no island, Allie said.
There is, or there was. The CDC abandoned the place in November. There was a revolt. They were using some experimental drugs that had killed some people, and the ungrateful sons of bitches seized control of the hospital. They said they didn't want a cure anymore. They were raving about how they had made their own cure. We're learning how to control fire. They were holding the medical staff hostage to deter military action. But they don't know our governor. He doesn't cut deals with terrorists. He commandeered a B-17 out of Bangor and dropped daisy cutters from one end of the island to the other. It's just a black rock now. They could see the smoke from Machias. That's when we made up the story about some burners having a bad reaction to one of the new medicines in the hospital burning up.
But we heard Martha Quinn on the radio, Harper pled. We heard her.
Yeah, we've got 100 hours of her on old recordings. We just replay them on a loop. The governor's argument has always been that this is the fastest way to wipe the epidemic out in the Northeast. Bring all the sick to one processing center, and then humanely dispose of them. Drop them in the North Atlantic Current, where there's no chance of the bodies washing back up in Machias. I am really, truly sorry.
You can't, Harper said. Please, my baby might be healthy.
At this, his face hardened. She could see his jaw tighten behind his mask. That's a lie. If you're sick, he's sick.
That's not true. You can't know that. There are studies.
I don't know what studies you've been looking at. It's true a lot of women who are sick will deliver babies without visible dragon scale. But blood tests show it lurking in the DNA, waiting to emerge. And I don't mind saying, I don't think much of a woman in your condition carrying a baby to term. You were a nurse. You had access to pills. You should have taken something a long time ago. Put yourself to sleep. The thought of you gestating a little guy loaded with disease, that makes me want to throw up over the side.
He cast a glance into the blackness, then looked back at them.
Look, I don't want to shoot you. It's better in the water. More peaceful. It doesn't matter you didn't get dosed up. The cold will put you to sleep inside 10 minutes. It's like the end of Titanic out there. Besides, if I have to shoot you, I might put a hole in the boat. It's inconvenient, you know? Help a fella out. Take off your vests. Pull the little boy out of his. Either we get out of our life vests, John Rookwood said, or you shoot us. Is that right?
He was tugging at the fingers of the glove on his left hand.
Jim nodded.
How about a third option? John said, yanking his glove free, throwing it over the side. His palm crawled with threads of gold light.
How about not? Jim said, and shot him in the stomach.
33. John touched his navel. His hand was still aglow, and it seemed he was bleeding light, that his palm was a saucer filling with gold. He was full of gold, and now it was coming out at him. A wave struck the side of the boat. It felt like they had slammed into a rock, it jolted them so hard, and John dropped ungracefully to the deck. Allie was trying to scream. Harper could see her at the edge of her vision, Allie's mouth open, the tendon standing in her neck, so it looked like she was choking. If she was actually making a sound, Harper didn't know, couldn't tell. She couldn't hear anything except the deep, hard wallop of her own pulse in her ears. Harper sank to one knee, gripping John's shoulder, turning him a little. The dirty water slopping around the deck was already turning red while his blood pumped into it. His face was white with anguish and shock. She felt for the wound, thinking, pressure, stop the bleeding first, then try and assess the damage.
Oh, he said, his voice a faint gasp. Oh, I've been shot right through.
God damn it, Jim said. Now there's blood all over the deck.
John, she said.
Oh, John, John, my love, please stay here. Stay with me. Please don't go.
Get away from him. Stand up and take your vest off, or I'll shoot you, too. I'd rather not. Please. It's better in the water. Easier, Jim said.
But she wasn't listening. The blood dripped into John's palm, sizzled and smoked, smelled like a burning frying pan. Harper wasn't crying, but he was.
I'm sorry, he said. I was so self-important, so full of myself, so fucking smug. I'm seeing it all, and I was so desperate for attention, so desperate to impress you. Oh, Harper, I'm sorry I wasn't a better man. I wish I was better.
You are perfect. You are the most perfect thing. You make me happy. You make me laugh. I never laughed in all my life like I laughed with you. You don't have to apologize for anything.
A weak smile twitched at the corners of his mouth. Maybe one thing. I apologize I didn't cook that halfwit with the gun before he shot me. But better late than never.
Gold rings flashed in his irises, his eyes brightening like steel coils with an electric current passing through them. The hand, hidden under his body,
began to leap with red flame. "Do me one favor," he said. "Please, promise me one thing."
"Yes, my love. Anything. Anything for you, John."
"Live," he said. Harper shoved herself away from him. He lifted his chin and opened his mouth, and Jim screamed, "What the fuck?" And a jet of yellow flame poured in a great hot blast from the fireman's open mouth. Jim raised one arm. Flame spattered over the yellow rubber of his suit, blistering the material. He reached to steady himself against the doorframe. The boat lunged over another wave, and Jim staggered and waved his gun wildly, pointing it into the cabin. It went off with a harsh blam. The skipper ducked. A window shattered. The armed sentry shouldered past Jim, lifting his assault rifle. Harper was already rising from her knee. The boat took another lurch and flung her into the soft, warm mass of Renee Gilmanton. The fireman ignited, all at once, with a soft, deep whoomp, as if someone had thrown a match on a pile of leaves soaked in lighter fluid. He was a roaring bed of flame, a nest, and a bird began to rise from it. A great red prehistoric thing with vast and spreading wings. The assault rifle thundered, splintering the deck. The boat slewed across a high wave. Allie grabbed Nick by the vest and stepped onto the cushioned seat and leapt. Harper had her arms around Renee and carried her over the side, and as she lifted, she had a sense of something tearing in her groin, in her abdomen. A man was screaming behind her. A yellow light was rising. She hit black water, so cold it burned. It was like dying. It was like spontaneous combustion. 100,000 silver bubbles spun around her in a frantic whirl. She came up gasping, caught a mouthful of salt water, and began to choke. A blazing bird of fire, with eyes of blowtorch blue and the wingspan of a single-engine airplane, opened its terrible beak and seemed to scream. A man who wore a shroud of flame twisted madly before it. The pilot's cabin was full of fire. Gray smoke boiled from the destruction. The boat was still moving, leaving them behind, already almost 100 feet away. Another wave slapped Harper in the face, blinding her, deafening her. Her vest carried her up and down in the tormented water. She rubbed her hands in her eyes and cleared her vision just in time to see the Maggie Atwood shatter as the flames reached what must have been a propane tank. There was a flash of white light and a blast of concussive sound that struck Harper like a blow, knocking her head back. She would discover her nose bleeding a few moments later. A blinding tower of fire rose into the sky from the immolated wreck of the boat. And a bird was hatched from that column of fire. A bird as big as God. It spread its wings and lifted into a sky of roiling black cloud, drew a great red circle of light in the sky, spinning above them. To Harper, it seemed magnificent and dreadful, a thing barbaric and triumphant. It circled once and again, and although it was high above them, Harper could feel its heat on her upturned face. Then it banked. Banked and began to sail away, giving its wings one slow, dreadful flap, leaving them in the sinking, burning, hissing wreck. Harper was watching it go when she noticed her thighs weren't as cold as they should have been. There was a sticky, unnatural warmth around them. Her water had broken. Delivery. The water seemed less choppy once she was in it. Her vest lifted her gently to the top of each wave and dropped her back down over the side. The motion was almost soothing, didn't make her feel seasick at all. Or maybe she was too numb, too frozen through to care. She already couldn't feel her hands, her feet. Her teeth were chattering. Renee blinked and sputtered, shaking her head. She peered around in a frightened, short-sighted sort of way. She had lost her glasses. "What? Did we capsize? Did we—" A wave caught her in the side of the face and she swallowed some, coughed and choked. Harper struggled toward her and took her hand. "Allie!" she screamed. "Allie! Where are you?" "Over here!" Allie cried from somewhere behind Harper. Harper kicked and waved her arms feebly and got turned around. Allie was making her clumsy way to her, towing her brother by the back of his vest. He was still asleep,
his plump, smooth face turned to the sky.
"God," Renee said when she could speak again. "So cold. What? What?
You were drugged. The stew. They were going to kill us. John. John."
Harper had to stop and catch her breath. Instead of trying to explain, she pointed at the wreck. The prow of the boat had already dived into the water, the stern lifting into the air. The big rusted blades of the motor, snaggled with seaweed and algae, revolved slowly in the night. The flames sputtered and seethed as the Maggie Atwood slid into the water. A great black oily bank of smoke mounted into the night. Harper moved her finger from the blazing ruin to the Phoenix, which was now no more than a distant bright glare of yellow in the night sky, like a remote passenger jet. Renee looked at her without any understanding at all. She was still half-doped, Harper thought, incapable of following any complicated chain of cause and effect. Allie caught up to them and took Harper's other hand. They were strung out in a line now, the four of them, kicking feebly in the black and icy water. Harper could see her breath, or maybe that was smoke.
"We'll die," Allie panted. "We're going to freeze to death."
"Sing," Harper said. Allie looked at her incredulously.
Harper lifted her voice and called out, "In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. Find the fun and snap! The job is a game." "Why?" Allie said. "Why? This is stupid. It's over. Does it matter if we die in 10 minutes or in 10 hours? We're going to drown out here."
Harper kept singing.
"And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, so sing. I'm not going to fucking argue with you."
She sang this last part right in key. Renee, blinking and rubbing at her face with her pudgy hands, joined her voice to Harper's. They kicked together in the water, their wavering voices rising and falling as their bodies rose and fell in the waves.
Allie's hands, scrawled with dragon scale, began to shine, a yellow light spreading up her wrists and under her soaked shirt. A warm brilliance shone from within the hood of her orange rain slicker. Her eyes brimmed with gold. The light seemed to race across her thin white fingers and up Harper's hand. Harper felt warmth. A deep, cozy warmth, rushing up her arm and across her torso, as if she were easing sideways into a hot shower. Their bodies smoked in the freezing water. When Harper looked at Renee, the older woman's eyes were alight. Her blouse was torn at the collar, and her throat wore a pretty choker of glowing gold wires.
"What about Nick?" Allie shouted when they had sung through the whole of a spoonful of sugar. "Keep singing," Harper said. "He doesn't have to be awake. He won't hear us anyway. We're singing for the dragon scale, not for him. Sing, goddammit! This is pointless! Are you alive?" "Yes!" "Then there's a point," Harper told her, and then couldn't say any more.
She was having contractions, hard ones. Her inside seized up, relaxed, and then seized up again. She had always wanted a water delivery. That had been all the rage not so long ago.
They were singing "A Spoonful of Sugar" a second time when the Maggie Atwood was sucked underwater with a last loud hiss, a blast of gray smoke, and a noisy roil of bubbles. They sang "Chim Chim Cheree." When they forgot the words, they made them up.
"Chim Chiminy, Chim Chiminy, Chim Chim a Chick, paddling in the water sucks a big dick," Allie shouted. "Blow me a kiss and you can blow it out your ass," Renee sang.
"Look," Harper said. Nick was glowing right through his sweater. Blue light swarmed beneath his hoodie. The water steamed where it touched his pink, warm, sleeping face. They started "A Spoonful of Sugar" again. Harper was in too much pain to join them, though. She clenched her teeth together and shut her eyes, weathering another series of contractions. When she opened her eyes, she saw the portable mother, her enormous black carpet bag, floating past them. The wide mouth of the bag was opened and filling with water. As Harper watched, it revolved in a slow, dreamy circle and sank out of sight, carrying everything she had meant to give her child with it.
She wished the phoenix had not soared away. For a long time she had been able to find it against the dark horizon, an intense breath.